So an important element of our mindfulness practice is investigating what our experience is. And many people associate meditation with relaxation, with becoming calm, with sometimes with bliss, becoming de-stressed or whatever. And all those things are certainly an element of meditation, or can be, and are helpful parts of meditation. But another important part that's often overlooked by people is the aspect of investigation, looking more deeply at our experience. And sometimes people, because investigation sounds a little bit like, oh, that's work, that's effort, people will shy away from it in meditation because they just want to relax. However, investigation is important. And when people are able to get somewhat calm or relax or stabilize their mind, it's important to use that as a foundation for your investigation. And sometimes people will get calm or settled in meditation, and then they'll just relax and get complacent, rather than seeing that as a tool that they've acquired or come across this wonderful tool that will allow them to do a much more careful investigation than they can if their mind is agitated and busy or whatever. And there's a number of ways of investigating. One way which I encourage people to do is, at the end of your daily meditation practice, is to finish your meditation, and then when you start getting up to go about your daily activities, don't just simply forget about your mindfulness, but use your investigation to pay careful attention to what happens to you as you leave your meditation, how you reconstruct yourself, your reality, your reactions to life. To the degree to which you're able to get calm in sitting, to that degree we've kind of put to rest some of our common preoccupations, some of the common reactivity that we have about our life. And then there's an opportunity to watch that sense of self, that sense of preoccupation, that sense of reactivity re-arise or reappear after we're somewhat calm. The calmer you get, the greater you'll notice the contrast between the settling of all these things and the picking it up again. Because sooner or later, you tend to pick it all up again. And so to watch that process is a very important part of meditation. It's also important to pay attention to how things occur in the opposite direction, particularly, for example, at the beginning of a meditation, to watch how, be sensitive to how a lot of the concerns, preoccupations, sense of self-preoccupation, tends to lessen and soften, perhaps, maybe just a little bit at first, but as you meditate, and watch that and see the contrast between a state of meditation where that's not operating so much and then your normal state where maybe there's a lot of self-preoccupation. And to watch how the process of settling, letting go of that happens as you begin your meditation. So both in starting the meditation and coming out of the meditation, investigation is a very important element of the practice. What I want to talk about today is a particular focus for that investigation that might be helpful for some of you. And that is the connection between your emotions that you have and that you experience and your sense of self, or more particularly, your conceit. Unless you're fully enlightened, it says in Buddhism that all people who are short of full enlightenment are visited by the wonderful little wiggly thing called conceit. So we're probably talking about most of us, certainly talking about me, and maybe about you. Maybe some of you have some element of this conceit, so it's interesting to explore. Conceit is not a very popular thing to explore. I don't know, in the world of psychotherapy, for example, how often conceit is actually investigated carefully and explored. Sometimes it is, and there's certain personality disorders like narcissism, which is well known in psychotherapy. But the kind of various books I've read on psychotherapy, Western psychotherapy, I myself don't see a lot of discussion about conceit. The sin of pride is often associated with religion rather than with psychotherapy. I don't say this as any kind of comment in psychotherapy. I just say it that perhaps as a culture, which we're a very, very psychotherapeutic culture, that maybe the topic of conceit isn't so often looked at and explored. Now, conceit in Buddhism has a very particular definition. And maybe it's different than how we normally think of the word. And maybe the word conceit maybe is not the best translation of the Pali word. So you have to kind of treat the English word a little bit lightly as I use it. But the Pali word is mana from heaven. It happens to be mana. And it refers to measuring ourselves, comparing ourselves in relationship to other people, establishing our sense of self-worth, our sense of self-importance or lack of self-importance, in comparing ourselves to others. And it doesn't matter how that comparison plays itself out. So in mana in Buddhism can be either thinking you're superior to someone, which is usual English definition of conceit, but it can also mean thinking that you're inferior to someone else, that you're less important or less worthy than someone else. That's also considered conceit. And then, oddly, for many of us here in the West, in this democratic culture we have, it's also considered conceit to have the conception, the idea, when you compare yourself to others, that you're equal to them. And that kind of throws people off. What do you mean? You know, I can understand the first two, but, you know, what's left? If I'm not supposed to consider myself either superior, inferior, or equal to others, you know, what's left? Well, what's left is not to compare yourself at all, not to bother. Now, certain level of comparisons is part of life, you know, to differentiate between people. And I was in the supermarket yesterday, and someone saw me walking by and said to me very nicely in Spanish and said, you know, please, will you please help me? Because the yogurt is way up high, you know, and I had the kind of height that was different than her height, and she could see that and compare that and knew that she couldn't get the yogurt, but I could. So a certain level of comparison is quite normal. But when we tie the comparative thinking with our sense of self-importance or self-worth, that becomes problematic, not in a moralistic sense, but rather, if you pay careful investigation to what's happening inside of us as we begin this comparative thinking and we associate our self-worth with that kind of thinking, usually it takes the form of the mind getting tight and contracted or heavy or brittle or, if nothing else, exhausted, because it requires work to be engaged in that kind of activity. Now, in normal kind of life, we don't necessarily see how conceit operates, and that conceit has a certain cost for our psychic being. But that's why the investigation, carefully, as you kind of start settling into your meditation, and you see how this operates, is very important, because you see, and if you can get settled enough in meditation, very quiet enough, so that you can watch the arising of a thought, and you can see that you have a choice about whether to get involved in that thought or not, then you can see the arising of a thought of comparative thinking. Oh, the person next to me, she's sitting really still. I hope no one notices that I'm fidgeting, because that's kind of embarrassing. After all, I've been sitting for 35 years. So all these comparisons are going on. So the thought arises of that comparative thinking. Maybe the thought itself is quite innocent. But then you can watch what it's like when the mind grabs onto that thought. It kind of believes the thought and starts getting engaged in it and starts kind of feeling a little bit sad or afraid or embarrassed or whatever the emotion might be that arises based on that kind of thought arising. And when the mind gets quiet enough, it's really wonderful to watch how you have a choice sometimes not to pick it up, that thought, just let the thought go by. But in terms of what I'm talking about tonight, what's more important is not so much your ability to let go of it, which is not always so easy to do, but rather you start noticing the cost of latching onto those ideas, the ways in which we make these comparative thoughts and the mind kind of leans into it or gets involved in it or clings, holds on, or resists or contracts or feels abhorrent to it. And all those reactions take energy, take effort. And you can watch then that it actually takes more effort to get involved in those thoughts than it does to let go of them and come back to a place of greater stillness. That make sense, what I said? So again, so it's not a moralistic issue about the problem of conceit in Buddhism, which it might be sometimes in Western religions, but rather it's an issue of, you know, you can, if you want to take of, you know, we don't want to, but, you know, a cost-benefit analysis. You know, so to watch, you know, what the cost is for, you know, this kind of contraction, this tightening of what happens around conceit and comparative thinking. And oddly enough, for some of us, in Buddhism, there's also the suggestion that in that conceit also takes the form of thinking that you're inferior to others, less worthy than others. That the implication is that certain kinds of shyness, maybe most kinds of shyness, which can be quite painful, and the stronger the shyness, the more it's the case that there's conceit involved. And many of us, when we think about shyness, don't think of the connection between shyness and conceit. We think someone's shy, maybe there's, you know, a very poor sense of self there, or they're, you know, but they're still, the person's very concerned about themselves and how someone else is going to see them. So they don't want to speak up because, you know, they're afraid that some, you know, that then they'll be seen as being foolish, or other people will reject them or reject that, you know. And so there's a very strong concern about the self, perhaps at times with shyness. And so it can be very helpful to investigate how a shy person is protecting a sense of self, protecting an idea of how we compare ourselves to others, how conceit is operating. Now, in terms of our emotions, that's another area of very important investigation. Not to take our emotions for granted, but rather to investigate how they get stimulated, how they arise, what are the conditions that bring on different emotions. In the course of our normal life, it might be very hard to notice what stimulates certain emotions at times, or certain moods that somehow just seem to kind of slowly kind of arise and be there. But that's where the investigation during meditation is very important. That to the degree to which you're paying careful attention in meditation, you might have a chance to see the cause and effect relationship between certain inner thoughts or feelings or reactions and the arising of certain emotional states. And it's here that you might notice that, I don't know if this is universally true categories, but I find it useful to think this way, that there are two general kinds of emotions. There are self-centered emotions, and there's what might be called self-transcending emotions. Or maybe we can call it reactive emotions and responsive emotions. And there's a certain class of emotions, the self-centered emotions, that those emotions arise based on some self-concept, some self, some conceit, some self, some idea of the self that you want to present to the world or you want to present to yourself. The re-presentation that you have of yourself. So, for example, so if I showed up here with, you know, I have this wonderful white shirt, and so, you know, I hope everybody admires me, if we can have this nice white shirt. I chose this white shirt today because I thought it would be just the day before the election, you should see me as a serious person, and, you know, and, you know, I respect the democratic process, and so I didn't just wear any old shirt, but I wore a nice white shirt. Because I want you to see me as someone who really respects democracy and, you know, and that whatever. And so, you know, that's how I want you to see me as someone in a particular way, and the white shirt kind of shows that. But alas, I go eat, you know, French fries before I come here. And somehow or other, in, you know, in my mindless state of eating French fries and ketchup, I spill ketchup all over my shirt. Lo and behold, I arrive here and I'm just feeling mortified and embarrassed and really afraid. And so I, you know, so I make sure to bring my sweater along, and, you know, I go, you know, hoping that no one's going to notice that I have ketchup, because if you notice I have ketchup on my shirt, you know, then, you know, you certainly won't think very well of me, and so my self-image, you know, is very threatened. So there's a whole class of emotions that seems to be arise out of how I'm concerned about people will see me, how you'll see me. And fear, anger, desire, even joy. Lo and behold, I managed to clean the ketchup off before I get here. Lo and behold, the shirt is definitely clean. I'm actually not quite confident that someone at the end of the evening is going to compliment me on this white shirt. And someone does, and it just makes my evening. I go home and I can hardly go to sleep because I'm buzzing with the praise. And so the praise and the joy and delight and the energy has very, in this particular situation, has a lot to do with how I want to be seen. My self-concept, my conceit. So there's a whole class of emotions that arise not automatically, it's not like an intuitive response to the situation, but it arises because some kind of information, some kind of perception of the world and ourselves is passing through an evaluation of who we think we need to be, who we want to be, how we want to present ourselves to others, represent ourselves to others. So the opportunity exists in meditation sometimes to watch very carefully how these steps occur in our minds. How there's the arising of a thought about a white shirt and what that means. And then the awareness, oh, I'm wearing a sweater. Maybe I should take off my sweater so people can see it. The fear that no one notices. So you can see kind of step by step. Whereas in daily life, it might happen so fast that we don't know how it arises. And for example, we might sometimes notice the so-called negative emotions, the emotions that cause us distress. But sometimes the joyful emotions that arise out of our self-evaluation, we're just willing to ride on it. That's really great. So if someone praises me of my wonderful white shirt, I'm not going to give that any second thought. Great, it must be true. And so I have to go home happy. And why should I question my happiness? The investigation of mindfulness, you don't want to kind of be complacent about even your happiness. You want to investigate that also to see, is it a reactive emotion arising out of a certain evaluation, a kind of self-centeredness, perhaps. So I'm calling this as self-centered emotions. There's another class of emotions which perhaps we can call self-transcending emotions. It's probably a very poor choice of the words, but responsive emotions, that the emotions that arise not through the filter of an evaluation or conceit, but rather arise because the conceit is absent, because the evaluation, the representation, is not the filter through which we're experiencing our life. So, for example, the Brahma Viharas, the divine abodes, the emotions of loving kindness, the emotions of compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, are very powerful and beautiful emotions, very important emotions, kind of stirring of the heart, that can arise quite independent of any evaluation of who we are and how we are, but rather can be just kind of the natural response of an open heart to the situation around. And there's a whole series of emotions which seem to be responsive to the situation, not reactive through the conceit of who we think we need to be. So a very important part then of investigation is to actually investigate the functioning of conceit and be willing to look at it, take some solace, perhaps, in the fact that we all have it, you know, and maybe not take it, because we all have it, not to take it so personally, not to take it as a personal failing, that this is there. It's almost like it's the natural, it's kind of, we don't want to call it the natural functioning of the mind, but it's, you know, you're kind of born with it, so if you're born with it, is it natural? So you don't take it so personally, kind of, oh, okay, there, you know, it's there. But to see it as something that's workable, something you don't have to be upset about or ashamed about. If you're ashamed about it or embarrassed about it, then it's just, you're allowing the conceit to operate even more. But rather to see it in a kind of, neutral way and kind way, gentle way, and then to investigate it, to understand it better, and to kind of to ferret out and investigate how this actually functions in your life, to use the what you learn in meditation and to see how this begins to work in your daily life. And as you do this investigation, I think you'll start finding that you can slowly become freer of the operation of conceit. Freer, you won't be so caught up anymore with your concern about how, kind of the neurotic concern about how people are going to see you. who you are and, you know, how we want to create an image of ourselves and in all the ways we do. So the connection between our emotions, or some of our emotions, and our self-concept. When is it that your fear arises because you're afraid of somehow your self-concept is going to be shattered or threatened? How often does your joy arise because your self-concept is being praised? Or how often does anger arise because your self-concept is threatened? Someone gets, you know, if one of you gets too close with to me with ketchup, you know, I might get a little bit, you know, afraid. And if you actually squirt the ketchup bottle on me, maybe I would get angry. And not because, you know, that was a mean thing that you did, but the strength of the anger might actually mostly be around the fact that now you've upset my self-concept. Not that I have to go find the laundry machine. So, not to take our emotions for granted, begin to investigate them a little bit. And look under the surface and see, is there some evaluation of self that might be operating there? And then as you do that, you might find this wonderful moment where you see the arising of a self-evaluation, a self-concept, a certain kind of conceit. And you see it arising, and you treat it very kindly and gently, and you just don't pick it up, just let it go. And you feel, wow, it'll feel so nice. Wow. I didn't have to get involved in that in any kind of way. That's probably enough. Yes, Jennifer.
We touched on some of this yesterday on Sunday, and so I had a chance to think about conceit and a lot of my self-image that I have. I was aware yesterday when Sunday evening came around, I thought, oh, you know, I started building up all this energy for the work week, and I thought, well, what's that about? And it's because I have this sense that I'm responsible and, you know, I'll be responding to all the requests, etc. So I felt all this energy. And my question is, for myself, is where something that happened tonight, and it relates to where is, you know, the line between being responsible and not following the clinging of my presentation of being a responsible person. So tonight there was someone who needed to be listened to, and so I was late to meditation, right? So, you know, it's important that I'm here on time so that, you know, I can tape or whatever, but it also is something that someone needed to be listened to. And you know, where is the line between being responsible and not clinging to an image that I'm a responsible person?
Oh, that's a great one. You hear all that question? I don't know exactly how to answer. And I think almost the question is so well stated that it's just almost better to leave it there and let it be an investigation. I think it's really, it's a matter of you investigating and seeing where that line is for yourself. And hopefully it becomes clear, you know, when you're concerned about a self-image and when you're just trying to be responsible. I mean, you have a commitment here of sorts, you know, responsibilities show up, and so that has a certain weight. Taking care of your friend has a certain weight, and how do you balance that? That's for you to kind of sort out, you know, how that works. But then you can see that there's a little kind of wiggling little thing. Oh, you know, Lewis always sits next to me, and he's going to notice that I'm late, and he's going to show up late, that I'm going to disturb him, and, you know, Lewis is going to be really, you know, perturbed, and I'm concerned about Lewis, you know, and what he thinks about me, and will he talk to me, and we know that Lewis is so kind that he's not going to be, you know, or maybe it's me, you know, maybe I, you know, I'm kind of ferocious, right, and you show up late, and and so you're concerned about, you know, the you know, image part. So it's for you to investigate and find out. And I know from my own personal experience that, you know, these kinds of things operate. Responsibility is my Achilles heel. And part of the reason for that, I think, is because sometimes of concern about what other people will think. It was a very, very good thing you said. Other comments or questions? Please.
I guess when you were talking, I realized that it's sort of hard to figure out who I really am, because I either react to things, which I don't want to do, or I think very carefully about how I'm going to talk to somebody or, you know, deal with some sort of a situation, but mainly, well, maybe not mainly, but to a fairly large part based on what they're going to think of me by how I'm handling it. And so I sort of look at that, and where am I in this sort of cloud of stuff in my interactions with other people?
That's also a good question, which maybe I should try to answer. You're giving me great questions. It's easy. I just don't answer. They better not answer it. It's a great question. But this is my response, for what it's worth. The concept of humility or humbleness doesn't seem to translate into any Buddhist word. And I asked Tanisara Bhikkhu, who's translated into English half the Buddhist discourses, about the word humility, and he kind of, well, you know, he couldn't think of anything particularly. And he thought, well, there's one word that maybe could be seen that, but he gave it to me. But I don't think it really should be translated as humility. But I thought it was very interesting, this great scholar of Buddhism couldn't find a word for humility in Buddhism, whereas in Western religions it's often considered a great virtue to be humble or have a certain amount of humility. But the word that he gave me, I looked up in the dictionary, and it meant gentleness. Mm-hmm. Gentleness. Oh, I think it's sagacha. Does that sound familiar? Sometimes Pali and Hindu, Hindi is, they're related, right? Like French and Latin, kind of. And so, you know, in terms of your answer, I don't know what you'll find, but maybe the approach is to look for the gentleness and be patient and be gentle with that whole phenomena, all that self-concern. Don't try to be humble about it, but try to meet it with your gentleness. And as you're gentle with it all, you probably find your way. Please. I didn't want to say that about any particular emotion. When I say there's a certain category of emotions which can come through the filter of conceit, they arise because of conceit is there first. And then because of that conceit, we feel threatened. Our conceit is threatened, so we get angry. I'm not saying that all anger is a result of that. Maybe that's very glad you clarified that, because maybe it wasn't so clear. What I'm saying is that there are two general classes of emotions, but the same emotion might be in both classes. That's for you to find out for yourself. I hope you don't get the idea, have a predetermined idea which emotions fit into which category of these two that I'm talking about, because that would have been a mistake, and maybe it's very helpful you clarify this. Rather, it's for you to do the investigation and find out what's actually true for you. Yes, Dick.
It's
8:47. 3 hours and 13 minutes until elections. So, thank you. And so can we have maybe 6 volunteers? People who could stay and who are noble, dedicated citizens of the country who will help set up for the election tomorrow? Can we have a show of hands, make sure that it happens? It's really important to offer our help, particularly this evening, so that... Great, so thank you. And if everybody else can help put the chairs completely away, that'd be appreciated also. Thank you.